Welcome to Book Tales with Rand Dugat and Heather Fowler. Today, we are excited to feature Jennifer Givan, author of Jubilee, a novel published by Blackstone Publishing.
Book Tales, Readings, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails? Well, we thought that having a cocktail while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading would be a really cozy idea. Today, we're drinking a Jubilee Rumrita, inspired by Jen's book. The recipes on the Hot Redhead Media blog link in the podcast description if you'd like to make a drink and join us.
For those not familiar with Jennifer's work, Jennifer Givan has been a National Endowment for the Arts and Penn Rosenthal Emerging Voices Fellow. She is a Mexican-American writer and activist from the Southwestern Desert. She is also the author of 4 full-length poetry collections, Landscape with Headless Mama, Protection Spell, Girl with Death Mask, and Roses Einstein. Her honors include the Frost Place Latinx Scholarship, a National Latinx Writers Conference Scholarship, the Lascaux Review Poetry Prize, Phoebe Journal's Greg Gummer's Poetry Prize, and more. Her work has appeared in Best of the Net, Best New Poets, Poetry Daily, Plowshares, Tri-Quarterly, Boston Review, Agni, Crazy Horse, Witness, Southern Humanities Review, and more. Givan holds a master's degree in English from California State University Fullerton and an MFA from Warren Wilson College. Of her new novel, Jubilee, author Sarah Pemberton says, "With a poet's gift for language and a cinematic eye for the texture of life in the California borderlands, Givan has created a novel in which the grit of daily existence is inextricably entwined with the power of the mythic. The complex, nuanced characters in Jubilee draw us into a woman's haunted past where trauma may have the capacity to wreck a life, but imagination has the ability to save it."
Jubilee is the story of Bianca, a young woman who appears at her brother's house one night with a doll in her arms, which she calls her baby. Through a series of alternating points of view, we follow Bianca's painful journey from her past to the present as she struggles with memories of her trauma and the possibility of having a new family. Jubilee reveals both the haunting power of our lived experiences and the surreal possibility of the present to heal the past. This novel is at once a darkly suspenseful psychological drama and a beautiful reflection of how beauty emerges from even the most traumatic of experiences. We can't wait to talk to Jen about it today.
How are you feeling today, Jennifer?
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I'm doing great, and it's so surreal to hear y'all talking about my book, which has been my heart and my passion for the past 10 years that I've been writing it, revising it, and working to get it published. And so we're talking about surrealism in the introduction, and it just feels so wonderfully surreal to have, and you're having the Jubilee cocktail. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah. That's awesome.
That's great. We are so looking forward to talking with you about your work and this and your poetry, and also hearing you read a 10 to 15 minute excerpt of Jubilee for us today. Do you enjoy giving live readings?
I do. I've been a poet all of my life. So even though this is my second novel, as you said, it's my sixth book, really, with four poetry books before this. And so that's my first passion, reading aloud. And every time I write my poetry and my fiction as well, I read it aloud to myself. And so it's really a lot of fun to be able to read it aloud to other people.
Yeah. You have a really great website. I was looking at that earlier. And I like how you ask people to subscribe to your newsletter. And in that, you self-describe as poet, she/her, novelist, mama, Chicana, feminist, bruja y curandera, author of the novels Trinity Site and Jubilee. Can you tell our listeners what a bruja y curandera is?
Yes, absolutely. So bruja and curandera come from the idea of a Mexican witch and a healer, respectively. Oftentimes, the bruja is seen as the diametrical opposite of the curandera in traditional kind of Catholic Latinx culture. However, more and more, as women are embracing their witchcraft, more and more women, and men as well, actually, and all people, are embracing the idea of spirituality outside of any kind of structural, systematic religion or doctrine, and reclaiming our own power, we're overturning the idea that a bruja and a curandera are separate or different from each other. A curandera is a healer and is often regarded highly in the Latinx culture, and people will go to her and, as I said, sometimes him for traditional healing, herbal medicine, that kind of thing. And it can go hand in hand with Catholicism. Mm-hmm. And brujería has been seen as a kind of shadow path, if you would, and maybe it would be embracing the darker sides of the magical or spiritual world. I tend to see them as two sides of the same coin, and that sometimes we need to look deeper into the shadow, which is what I do quite a bit in Jubilee, looking at the trauma that's led to the circumstances around Jubilee's presence in order to find the healing. And so with the brujería and the curanderisma, they go hand in hand in my own practice as well as in my art and my writing.
Interesting. Thank you for sharing that.
It's so vivid and it's so visceral as well, and such a wonderful way of thinking about representing yourself. I mean, it makes you so bold as a woman right off the bat. And that was something that I observed too, Ran, when I saw her website. So the question that I have about this, because I'm fascinated by it, one of my best friends is into Wicca, and I've noticed that a lot of people I know practice some witchcraft. How does that enter the work? I know you were mentioning that it had been some of the energy that informs that maybe has gone into Jubilee, but has witchcraft or healing medicinal type things entered your actual trajectory? Do you see that coming into the work visually, or is it just kind of more in the background as a vibe?
Absolutely. So all of that. So when I first began delving deeper, the answer is everything. When I began delving deeper into my spirituality and exploring the ancestral roots to curanderisma and brujería, I would integrate my practice. So as I would write, for instance, I would light a candle and say a prayer before I began to write and, you know, enter that meditative creative space, ask my ancestors or my antepasados to come and speak to me and speak through me. And that became a kind of a ritual for my writing. And it entered into my poetry, even from my earliest books. For instance, my second poetry book is Protection Spell. And in many ways, I'm casting or conjuring a protection spell for my children, particularly my son, who identifies as Black. Both of my children are biracial, but the world tends to see my son, you know, in a certain light. And there's some ideas of light skin privilege that I discuss as well. So I use the spells, I use the spirituality to investigate the societal and sometimes racist oppression that people of color and Latinx people face. And so in many ways, it becomes a tool of empowerment, not just for myself as the writer, but also within the words themselves. And so that I hope that my readers are feeling that empowerment as well and can take that with them, a tangible tool. As I read, for instance, I carry the words with me as a mantra and as a kind of protection spell so that I can carry with me the words of Toni Morrison, for instance, and the words of Sandra Cisneros. And when I'm in a situation that's difficult, I have those with me as a kind of a prayer. In my home, in your pocket, I have their words as a kind of a mantra prayer in my pocket. And then lately, in my latest novel that I've just finished and I've sent out to my agent, I actually wrote a novel that centers on the magic and spirituality of people of color. It's a psychological thriller, and the magic is protecting them from law enforcement. And it's a murder mystery. And so you'll have to read it to see. I don't want to give too much away of the murder mystery, but the magic plays an integral role. And I get into the brujería and a little bit of Wiccan and hoodoo as well. My partner, his family is Black, and he introduced me to the idea of hoodoo and granny magic from the South that his family was involved in. So I integrate all of that into my third novel.
What? When can we have it?
I know. It's out with my agent right now, so I've been conjuring, that a big book deal is coming. I feel it.
Okay, I feel it for you too, because I already want it. So here you go.
Thank you.
Well, when did the idea for Jubilee originate?
That is such an interesting question, because I feel that it's been a part of my soul and my psyche since I was about 16 years old, when I experienced a situation that runs parallel to my protagonist B. It is fiction. I'm not writing a memoir, but much of what I lived through in the Imperial Valley, which is a small border town on the Mexicali-California border. And what I experienced down there runs parallel with Bee's own trauma that is discussed in the past timeline of her story. And so I knew that I had this story to write when I got out of the valley safely by the skin of my teeth. I almost didn't make it out of the valley safely. And I did. And when I came out, I had a story burning within me that I had to tell. And I enrolled back in college. I was going to community college after dropping out of my first semester at university. I was in community college in a creative writing class, and I wrote the first draft. I was about 19 years old, and it was terrible, I'm sure, the quality of the writing. I'd never written fiction before, except, you know, and just in my own journal. And where I grew up in the Imperial Valley, there were no writing workshops, no poetry classes or poetry slams or coffee shops or anything like that. I had no idea that these kinds of craft workshops and tools existed for me. And so I just found a creative writing class at the community college and wrote my first story there. And it was what ended up becoming a chapter in Jubilee. I mean, I revised the heck out of it, but that root was there since I was 19 years old, and I was 36 in May. So time doesn't mean anything anymore. I can't remember when I turned 36, but I'm 36. And so what is that? 17 years? Is that right? I don't even know if I'm doing my math right.
It's 19 to 36. Blink, right? I mean, in some way, there are some things in your life you will never forget. They happened 30 years ago, but you never forget. And there's some things that takes you 10, 15 years to process before you're ready to write, don't you think?
Absolutely. It wasn't until my daughter was born and I was 26 years old. So I wrote that first story when I was 19, and then I didn't really do much with it. And then when my daughter was born, I was 26. We had moved to New Mexico, and I was nursing her, and I heard about this thing called NaNoWriMo, and I'm like, well, you know, I'm always with my daughter, but, you know, at 30, writing a book in 30 days, like, let's try it. Why not? And I did. And like I said, I was nursing her. So, I mean, I was literally like holding my daughter in my arms and typing away at the keys, you know, 5 in the morning. I have no idea how I did it. I don't think I could do it again in that way. But
isn't NaNoWriMo like 1400 words a day or something like that? Like, were you using a word count?
I was doing 2,667 words per day.
Ooh, that's a lot.
It is a lot. I know.
I'm excited if I hit 1,000.
I know. Yeah. I mean, exactly. I really think that it was just pure passion. I had to write this story, and I'd been scared of it. You know, it's a story so close to my heart, and I didn't have the formal training. I didn't know what I was doing. I just knew I had to get it out. And so I was really thankful for NaNoWriMo, which lit a fire under me and just gave me the motivation to do it. And it was like, it doesn't matter if it's good or not, because my goal right now is just to get it out.
Yeah.
What was the revision process for it then?
So I sent it off to a writer that I had met in the Penn Emerging Voices Fellowship Program. She was a few years ahead of me and had written several successful novels. And like I said, I didn't have any formal training. I didn't really know what to do, but I remembered her from the program. And so, which I had taken it in poetry, but she's a fiction writer. So I sent it off to her, and she sent it back to me. You know, and I was so hopeful and bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and she sent it back to me. And it was just covered page after, you know, every single page. Covered in her pen marking and her notes, you know. And at the time, I was still pretty much a baby writer, and it was disheartening at first. I cried and cried. I told my mom, she hated it, you know. But then I got back to work because I had this story that I had to tell, and I started working with a mentor whom I'd met again through the Penn Emerging Voices program, had hooked me up with a mentor at the UCLA Writers Extension, and she had agreed to work with me for a discounted price. I couldn't even afford the fee at the time. I was an adjunct with my two young children, but she was going to work with me, and she really helped whip me into shape. And this is Lynn Hightower. I highly recommend her. If you know anyone's listening and they're looking for a drill sergeant who's going to help get them, whip them into shape, Lynn Hightower was great. And she taught me most of what I know now about plot and not falling into the I call it the black hole of backstory, because that's where I just lived in my first draft of my novel, was all just backstory. And so she really helped me whip the plot into place. And it took about 6 months. I just worked my butt off every single day, revising. And then I cold called, I sent it out to agents, and I had found an agent for it within just about a month or so. I mean, we had worked so hard on it. But that first round with my agent, she loved it as well. And I did another round of revisions. But when we sent it out to all of the publishers, it was ultimately rejected everywhere. Wow. And so this was about 7 or 8 years ago, and was discouraged, but I still didn't want to give up. And I kept on working on it. And at the same time, I also had an idea for my next novel, which was Trinity Site. And I sat down and I started writing that. And then I thought, you know, I really could use some more training. You know, I still don't know that I know 100% what I'm doing. Every time I sit down to write a new novel, I feel like, what am I doing? Like, how did I ever write that other thing? It feels like such a brand new beast every single time. And I have to learn, like relearn how to write every time I have a new story idea. Yeah, so I went back for my MFA, which was in poetry, oddly enough. But that poetry MFA really helped me learn how to write the second novel. And by the time I finished the program, I sat down, I had won the National Endowment for the Arts, and I had some time. I had some financial freedom that allowed me to sit down and write, and I was able to put my kids in daycare, and I was able to write my second novel within about a year. I finished it and then sent that out. And by this time, I think with the MFA and everything, several years had passed. And so I sent my second novel out to a new agent, and she loved it. She loved Trinity Site. And she said, absolutely, I'll represent you. And this is going to be great. And I said, oh, thank you so much. Well, I also have this other manuscript. And I slipped Jubilee in, and she kind of rode on Trinity Site skirts and slipped in under the radar. And Blackstone Publishing, my publisher, loved Trinity Site, and they agreed to read Jubilee as well. And they loved it as well. And so I went, I guess it was about 8 years or so, maybe it was 7 years, with no book deal. And then with overnight, I had two books that they'd accepted, and they wanted to read my third book, which I hadn't even written yet. So it was like overnight, no book deal to three book deal.
That's so encouraging. As somebody who's in the querying stage right now, that's really, really great to hear.
Absolutely.
And I'm really fascinated about the poetry element. I mean, we were introduced to you as an author when we had Shandel Beers on our podcast, and she was talking about your relationship with each other as authors and how you had worked with some of her poetry. And so, of course, that informed my thoughts as I was reading this novel. As I was reading Jubilee, I was thinking the novel itself is very poetic. It's referential to poetry. And you have a really accomplished resume as a poet, several books, which doesn't come like a snap. I mean, it takes energy and people enjoying your work to create whole books of poems. So what I was curious about is it appeared that most of your publishing was of poetry that came first. Is that right? First, you can speak to your trajectory a little bit. And then the other thing I wanted to check in with you about is how do you feel your poetry writing informs your prose writing and editing and vice versa? Even if you had a manuscript, did all of that training with the poetics really change or inform anything you were doing with your work?
Absolutely. So it's so wonderful that you bring up Shandel Beers. She's such a dear friend. And she and I met just by chance at a poetry conference at my alma mater. We'd both been invited to speak there at Cal State Fullerton and became fast friends and have been reading and loving and supporting each other's poetry ever since. And so I was really glad to have met her. That was very early on in my poetry career before I had a book out or anything. So she was a mentor of mine, and then we kind of became mentors to each other. And so that was lovely. I'm so glad that she introduced me to you as well.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, all the good writers introduce each other to each other.
Exactly.
She's like, but I know this poet. I know this author. And she actually talked about the Trinity novel on the podcast earlier, which was kind of great. So I've been very excited to have you come on, and I'm so glad you're here with us today.
That's awesome. Thank you. So yeah, I've been writing poetry all my life. I mean, deep down, I see myself as a poet. And there are many stories that I can only tell as novels, and they really do need to be in the prose format. But as you noticed, my prose format is still very lyrical. That's the way I think. That's the way I feel. That's just the way I move through life, is through poems. And a lot of the sitting down to write the novels is just me figuring out how to piece together all of the poems that I've either literally drafted into my notebook or in another poetry collection that needs to be expanded now. There's a character in there, or there's an event or some situation that now needs to be expanded upon. And so often what happens is that while I'm working on whatever piece of writing I'm working on, I have a poetry collection going simultaneously with whatever novel I'm working on. And they're informing each other in really concrete ways as I'm researching. And so that's what happened with my fourth poetry book, Rosas Einstein, and Trinity Site, which both touch on and use my research on Los Alamos and the first atomic bomb that was created here in New Mexico, in Los Alamos, and then detonated in White Sands down by Las Cruces. And so that research informed both the poetry book and the novel. They're two very different stories, but they come from the same root. And so that's often what happens with my writing process. And with my most recent book as well, I told you that I wrote a psychological thriller about magic. And then my latest collection that I'm sending out right now, Our Lady Underbelly, touches on the magic and the witchcraft and the brujería, and how the speaker of the poems uses that as protection for her family, her biracial family. So they often go hand in hand, and there are ideas then that I'm mapping out, that I'm thinking through, and they come initially as lyrics, as fragments. They come as kind of associative, you know, just stream of consciousness thinking on the page. And then I say, okay, now I need to really get myself together here. And I make myself a notebook for the fiction, because plot is something that I have to be rigorous on myself and really, you know, whip myself into shape. As I told you, my mentor, Lynn Hightower, taught me some tricks of the trade with plot. That's something that I have to really work hard on, because the poetry just flows out, and I could write poetry for days. For years, I've been writing poetry, a good 30 years since I was a little girl. But with the fiction, I have to plan it out, and I have to, you know, plot it. I'm definitely a plotter, because otherwise, otherwise the books would meander. Yeah, I mean. My first, like I said, Jubilee was a pantser, because I just had to get it out in during NaNoWriMo. So I was flying by the seat of my pants. But with the second two novels, I had to plot, because I thought, you know, what I went through in the revision process for Jubilee was trial by fire, you know, and I barely made it out unscathed, mostly unscathed. So now I plot. But I think the poetry really helps, because then by the time I'm at the plotting stage of a novel, I've already worked with these ideas. I've already begun to hone them and shape them and find the heart of them. And now I can start to put them into story form. And so I really love that I have that poetry background, and I tease all of my fiction writing and prose writing friends. I tell everyone that at heart, all writers are poets, you know, and I say it in jest, but at the same time, you know, poetry is concerned at the level of words, at the level of diction, at the level of, you know, idea and moment and desire, just in the moment desire. And so I think that fiction is really just expanding on that and, you know, shaping it into something that has some semblance of a plot. But otherwise, I think we all have to be poets.
I like that. I'd like to stay with the focus on language for a minute. I have to tell you also, I really, really appreciated all the references in your novel. It made me homesick because I have family in Southern California, and it made me homesick for my Mexican family there, because you had every page had something that I connected with, from conchas to cumbias, even Whittier, where my cousin's sister grew up, and I used to go visit her.
Oh, cool.
So yeah, I loved it.
Right before we moved to New Mexico, I was back in Whittier. That's where I was born, and I lived there until I was 6, and then we moved to the Imperial Valley, and then I left when I was about 19, and then went back to Whittier, and that's where I was, and that's where I met my partner, whom I've been with since I was 20, and that's where we adopted our son, and I gave birth to our daughter, and then we moved to New Mexico. So I absolutely love Whittier and miss it. That's where all my family, my extended family still is.
I know. I get it. Mine is there too. And I see him a couple times a year. I go out there and see him. When you were writing Jubilee, you included so many wonderful cultural references and Spanish words. And I was wondering how you were envisioning your non-Spanish speaking readers encountering that.
Absolutely. So I've often had editors ask me if I wanted to italicize all of the Spanish words. Words, and I say, no, thank you, because the Spanish words, which are usually no more than a sentence or two, there might be lyrics from a song that might run a couple of lines, but usually it's a word here and a word there. And that's how right. I think, that's how I speak. That's the kind of Spanglish border language that I grew up with. I am not fluent in Spanish. My grandparents are fluent in Spanish, but they were raising my mom and her 6 brothers and sisters during a time in the 1950s and 60s when it was really frowned upon in their neighborhood in Whittier and everywhere that they lived outside of Los Angeles to be Mexican and to speak Spanish. They wanted to give their children the best opportunities and the best education that they could. And my grandfather had been so maligned and mistreated for speaking Spanish first and then learning English second. And he'd been made fun of in school. And so he didn't teach my mom Spanish. And so what I learned of Spanish was her broken Spanish, you know, the lullabies and just the home Spanish, I guess that you would call it. So where her words and her fragments are Spanish, but her sentences are primarily English. That's what I learned. And then also living on the border, people were speaking Spanish all around me. And so I absorbed it through a kind of an osmosis. And then my boyfriend, whose family I was very close with, would speak Spanish. And they called me La Jena. Jena was for my name Jen, because Jenna was what they called me. They didn't know at first that I was Mexican. He just said, you know, Jennifer, and my maiden name is Boyce. So they said, Jennifer Boyce, and he brought me home and, oh, La Jena. And then she realized, oh, wait, she is Mexican-American. But so my culture is already very mixed, very fluid, and that's what my books are. I would say that is absolutely what my books are. And so there is a place for anyone who has that kind of experience, not necessarily, it doesn't have to be with Mexican-American culture or Chicana culture, but the idea of border spaces, of not quite fitting in anywhere, but your heart, pieces of your heart are everywhere through a kind of an osmosis with the land and the people and the experiences that have shaped you. And that's what La B in the book is supposed to symbolize or does symbolize for me. And so I would hope that even if a reader doesn't speak Spanish, that if they want to, it's very easy now to just translate things. You can have a translator on your phone. You can look it up through Google very easily. And they're all phrases that are used commonly amongst Spanish speakers. So for instance, like chones is when their chonies is underwear. And that's just what we call underwear. And chanclas, that's sandals. And yeah, it's like la chancla, you know, that's just, that's something so common that I don't even think of the word sandal when I look at a sandal and I see chancla. So why would I change my language and my experience to fit someone else? So what I would hope then is that readers would meet my books and really the works of anyone who's bicultural and writing elements of different culture, different language into the work, would meet the book on its own terms. And the other thing is, even if a reader didn't look it up, the context clues will give the meaning away. So, really, yeah, the reader could just feel into the book. And that's the goal anyway, because as I said, I'm not fluent in Spanish. So I didn't always know all of the words happening around me, but it was the feeling, it was the emotion. And when I think of the Imperial Valley, I hear the Spanish, even if I don't always know the proper conjugation of the verbs and all of the meanings of the words, it's like a music. You know, I don't read music, but I can feel music. And so that's what I'm hoping will happen with the Spanish culture in the book.
Yeah, I think so for sure. You know, my parents. My mother had the same exact experience. She, Mexican-American, grew up in LA in the 50s, and her parents both spoke Spanish and did not teach her Spanish.
It was such a common experience. And so a lot of Chicanas and Chicanos now feel cut off, but I love that from the language, but I love that Gloria Anzaldúa in her criticism has so many ideas about what Chicanas and Chicanos, Latinx peoples, their connection to language. And we all have our own ways of living the Chicana and Chicano experience, whether we speak Spanish or not. And so she says that too often Chicanas might not even feel like they can communicate, not knowing if they speak Spanish or not, not knowing if they speak English and not wanting to embarrass each other. And so I think there's so much in my books about getting rid of that shame, getting rid of that stigma. And Bea shares how her mom didn't speak Spanish to her. And she deals with that idea of what is her identity and really claiming her identity because she is a Chicana. She grew up on the border. Her dad is white and her mom is Mexican, but that doesn't make her any less authentically Chicana. And so that's absolutely something that I want to encourage anyone who's bicultural to embrace their identities and not feel ashamed, whether they are masters of the language or not. I mean, it's okay to speak Pochol Spanish. It's okay to speak broken Spanish. Like, that's a legitimate language that we can communicate with each other through.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, it's so funny because I've pretty much grown up in San Diego, so I'm a half an hour north of the border. So for me as a reader, it's almost like reading Spanish words is just part of the cultural capital of where I live.
Exactly.
If that makes sense too.
Yep. Exactly. That's because, the Southern California experience, whether, no matter what culture you are, if you grew up in Southern California or you spend a significant amount of time there, you are going to embrace so many Spanish words because that's just the language there now. Yeah. Or always, really. I mean,
because it's the language, but also because every single time you get on a bus, everywhere you look, there's a bilingual translation in Spanish.
Absolutely.
And it keeps the city running. It lubes the people's ability to understand what's happening where, because there's a large Mexican American, Latina, you know, Chicana, Chicano presence in San Diego, period. So it doesn't feel like, I know when I was growing up, I felt like it was just very normal. We're all here, you know?
Exactly.
Like, it was more unusual for me to see people of other races. Like, the amount of people, the amount of Black people, for example, in a classroom would be much smaller than the amount of Caucasian and, you know, Mexican American kids in the classroom. So it was very funny that it felt very normal to me, which I think was what attracted me to taking your book on for our podcast as well, because I love to read things that are set in California. I feel there's a real shortage of that. Everyone wants to set things on the East Coast. I know I've mentioned this before, but seeing more California literature makes me so happy. I'm not going to lie.
Me too.
And then in terms of the border, I mean, how much literature is really set on the Southern California border? We often hear about the Texas border, the Arizona border, but there really is a paucity of Southern California border literature. And so I'd rarely seen myself in my hometown or ever. I'm not sure that I ever saw it in literature. So,
You also look at the voices you want to hear from are not always the ones who are included in literature. I hate to say this, but it does feel like it's a very elitist craft sometimes, and that you need things like Pen Emerging Voices and these other groups that are championing voices that otherwise would not feel like they have a right to have a place at the table, or they wouldn't even know how to get to the table.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe the people in their home are not encouraging them. They don't think doing literature is a valid pursuit. Maybe they worry it doesn't make any money. Like, there's a lot of things that create a feeling about what career is acceptable, what path in life you should move on. And if you don't have any influences driving you in a direction that you might be naturally driven toward, that's an almost more beautiful thing when you find that path, don't you think?
Absolutely. I tell all writers, and especially marginalized writers, women of color, that you're knocking at the door, and if they're not letting you in, you keep knocking. If they don't let you in, you go around, you go to the back, you find a fire escape, you climb it up, you open up the window, get inside, and then you fling that door open. Come on in, everybody. That's and that's really what I feel like I've been doing.
Yeah. Yeah. It invites and it gives permission to others, which I think is such a beautiful thing, you know? So I want to ask you about another element of the book, because to me, it is almost the biggest thing thematically. It's almost the hobby horse of the book. And perhaps it's one of your main themes in your work as well. But one thing that I was really fixated on is the idea of motherhood, the idea of the significance of motherhood, of the value of motherhood, of the way it creates value for people in the community in your book. So I wanted you to kind of talk about that. It moves through your text in such a strong thematic way. Can you speak to what you would like your work to bring to readers on the subject of motherhood, of being female and parenting?
So growing up, I was closest with my mom, who didn't have a way out of her community and her situation and her family. She wanted to go to college, but she wasn't encouraged or even allowed. Her parents had told her basically no. And so she got married right out of high school and had my brother, and then her husband left her to be a single mom. Then she met my dad a few years later and had me. And all the while, she was earning her nursing licenses and then degree. She worked her way up from a CNA to an LPN to an RN all the way up. And now, as I was having children of my own, my mom kept going to school and is now a doctor of nursing. And so she just kept working. And now she's the dean of a nursing school. Yeah. And so growing up, that's the influence. The biggest influence that I had was my mom, who just motherhood really shaped her identity, not necessarily at first by choice. She got pregnant and, you know, she decided that she was going to throw herself into motherhood. And that was always first and foremost in her life. And so I grew up with that example. And then also in my own family as well, motherhood is what the women did. And so to a certain extent, you know, that is a part of the Latinx culture, that motherhood is expected of you, though that's changing now. And I'm glad that people are seeing that there are other options, even within the very devoutly Catholic and the very family-oriented Latinx culture, that motherhood is still important and revered, but that it's not the only path that one needs to take. But growing up, that was primarily what I saw. And then growing up on in the valley, whenever I refer to the valley, it's the Imperial Valley, which is right there on the Mexicali border. So growing up in the valley, that's what I saw all around me, was women having children, and often from a very young age. And so several of my friends in high school had children in high school. And for instance, with La B in Jubilee, her boyfriend Gabe tells her that his father, Hector, will warm up to her once they have their first child. And she's maybe 15, 16 years old. And yet this is just the norm. It's expected. I mean, they're going to have children together. That's just the way that it is. And so partly I wanted to represent that culture and examine it and not necessarily just say, this is negative, you know. And if we look at it from the perspective of, for instance, white feminism that really started having its heyday in the 1960s and then has evolved from there, I mean, then we would say, well, this is wrong. Of course, you know, this is wrong. And I've had white feminists read my work and, you know, just kind of be appalled at the desire for mothering that's so strong in B from the time that she's a very young teenager. But I wanted to show that, yes, we can critique it and we can see the roots of it and we can understand it without just implying a context that doesn't necessarily fit perfectly, and that there are other paradigms and other ways to see this, that motherhood can still be something beautiful and respected and really in all cultures. And it's okay for a young woman, or, you know, even for anyone really, regardless of gender, to want to have children. And so I really wanted to convey that La B is strong and feminist and powerful, not despite the fact that she is innately a mother and desires to mother, not despite the fact, but in part because of, right? I mean, that is something that gives her joy and hope and love and fills her with the imaginative possibility to create. And she doesn't ever impose that belief. I would never impose that belief on anyone. Motherhood needs to be individual choice. And I state that in the book as well. Lobby is all about choice, and as am I. But I want to represent the possibility that motherhood, even from a young age, can still be a beautiful and empowered choice. I adopted my son when I was 23 years old. And after experiencing infertility and miscarriage and child loss, and then I gave birth to my daughter when I was 26. So most of my 20s, I spent mothering, and I still managed to do all of the things, write all of the books and earn the degrees. And I would say that it wasn't in spite of the fact that I was mothering, but they went hand in hand. And my craft is so much about finding wholeness as a self. And for me, that self includes mothering. And so I wanted to give voice to other women whose experiences reflect or are akin to my own, where mothering is something empowering. Too often in the literary world, mothering can be given lip service, and in the real world as well. Oh, motherhood is great, but... And so for young women, especially, to be mothering can be seen as strange or a throwback, or that somehow they're not as empowered as they might be. And so feminism is so wonderful, but it can tend to be judgmental in that way, I found. And so
don't you think that there's a lot of intersectional feminist judgment? I mean, coming back both ways, back and forth, right?
Sometimes
I feel like I'm traumatized just by reading feminists beat each other up, to be honest. Sometimes I just feel like I wish that I understand that the intersectionalism has a component that's really important for particularly white feminists to understand. But I also get that I wish that we would come together instead of biting each other's tits off, if that makes any sense.
Exactly. And exactly. I don't know about that image, but...
Well, sometimes I just feel like it's exactly what you're talking about right now. You're saying sometimes white feminists feel like they're giving some judgment vibes towards espousing or embracing the idea of motherhood, because in their mindset, in their cultural capital, early motherhood is a life destroyer, right? In their mindset, a lot of times it keeps women from going to college or doing these other things or whatever else. They might feel it creates a forced dynamic of domesticity that they may not value or want. Maybe they feel like it's a throwback to the time of three generations ago of the women and their family, and it's creating something that limits more than empowers, if that makes sense. And being a single parent, I deeply feel how much time parenting takes. So I understand that very deeply, but I also understand your point. There are beautiful things about motherhood and wanting to be a parent that should be able to be embraced without being criticized, right?
And it's so funny too, because I was just telling my partner that thinking back about the books that I've written so far, I often write very complicated mother relationships with mothers and their children, mothers and the rest of their families, daughters toward their mothers. And so it's not that I'm in any way idealizing it. I mean, as you say, motherhood takes so freaking much time and energy, and I'm exhausted half the time. And so even as I acknowledge all that it's given to me, I see the other side of the coin and what might I have done had I chosen not to have children until later in life. Well, that's fine. I wanted to be a mom, and I'm so glad that I am. But part of my work also is showing the very complicated relationships. And again, I'm not straying away from criticizing what needs to be criticized and examining what needs to be examined. But I just want to show that motherhood is so important and really worthy of writing, you know, literature about it. And I feel not just in my own writing, but in the writing that I love to read, it's worthy of being reviewed and getting into the New York Times and winning prizes. And so often I don't see in poetry and in fiction that work that focuses on motherhood really gets the credit that it deserves. And that's why I say that a lot of times it's given a lip service, but not really the merit. And I mean, even books about fatherhood tend to get more applause.
So they seem to get brushed under the rug a little bit.
Well, and exactly. It's because I can tell you exactly what that is. That's people calling it women's fiction, which makes me like red in
me
the
too.
Face, you know, steam shooting out the ears. Because why is it a women's fiction when it's about a topic that's a human topic?
Exactly.
And then if you see a book where it's a male character writing about their mother, it's not women's fiction then.
I know.
So why is that?
I know.
So some of the women who I love get kind of around that by writing boy characters or men characters, even as they're examining motherhood and violence against women. And so I'm thinking of, for instance, Louise Erdrich, who won the National Book Award, and as well as Jesmyn Ward, who won the National Book Award. So I'm thinking of The Roundhouse from Erdrich and Sing Unburied Sing from Ward. And both are deeply, you know, beautiful feminist, difficult, harrowing accounts of motherhood. But one of the speakers in both books is a young boy who's looking at his mother and what she's going through, and both won major awards. So I think that it's wonderful that women writers also see that our writing is often relegated to women's literature. And so we're using that paradigm and turning it on its head and maybe sneaking in. Like I said, you got to sneak in through that fire escape. And I, you know, some of my heroes are doing that. And so,
yeah. Yeah.
That's who I'm aspiring to.
Yeah, another thing I think people are doing is straddling genres. I know I do it myself. I write magical realism. I write experimental fiction. I write all kinds of different things. And I write feminist work too. But sometimes I write in a genre that may be male dominated on purpose and put in a lot of different things that to me are deeply feminist in kind of a combinatory play fashion in order to sneak them past, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
No, because if it's magical realism, no one's allowed to call it women's fiction, friends. Let's be honest, right?
Exactly.
Magical realism. So, exactly. You know, if it's dystopia, you're not going to be a women's fiction dystopia writer. You might be a feminist dystopia writer, but.
That's exactly what I did with Trinity Site. I got away with having my protagonist be pregnant. She's a Latina, pregnant with twins, tromping through the desert, you know, fighting monsters, kicking ass, and nobody's calling it women's fiction. You know, here, right? I've got this Latina pregnant woman, but it is science fiction. It is, which I don't think it's science fiction, but that's what it's been called, magical realism. But again, those male dominated fields. And so I've got a bunch of men reading it, and which I love, you know, that I didn't necessarily write it for them to read it. I wanted women to have role models, and I wanted to see ourselves pregnant and kicking ass. But exactly what you're saying. I love it. Oh my gosh.
All right. I'm going to switch us back because I could talk to you about this for days. Honestly, I totally could. But I'm going to switch us back to the focus on Jubilee for a minute because I want to make sure we get to a couple of the questions that we have and some of the other things I want you to speak to. So one of the things I really loved about this book that I definitely want to mention is this element that you bring in about the lousy old boy, right? The one who starts as a friend or young kind of innocent love and then sometimes just becomes morally bankrupt or not right for this character. And so we realize that this character has to kind of grow out of him. But she will grow out of him with some memorable trauma in this narrative. And I just wanted to say you really hit a chord there with me. And I think a lot of other women are going to find it that they really resonate with this experience of the lousy old boyfriend they outgrew or became too powerful for. Did you plan to have such a strong juxtaposition arc in the work with this?
So what I wanted to show was how our identity is often shaped by who we love and who we choose to let in. And, you know, as you say, she outgrew, Labi outgrew Gabe. And that's so true. And it took her the longest time to see that. But that's ultimately what I wanted to show. And in terms of the juxtaposition between that lousy old boyfriend and then there's the, I love how you say that. And that's what I'm going to think of Gabe as from now on, the lousy old boyfriend.
My mom
had some choice words for that character. And my mom, she's a devout Catholic and is usually, you know, just very reserved, but she had some words about that character. So I'm going to tell her that you said he's a lousy old boyfriend.
We all had words about that character.
And then the Josh character, someone in a book page review called him like the trademark nice guy, you know? And so there is a juxtaposition there. And my kids were asking me the other day about who was Virginia Woolf's husband if she married, because we were reading A Room of One's Own together and talking about how a woman needs to have a room of one's own or of her own to write and to be a thinker and to have freedom. And I said, well, she did get married, but her husband, Leonard Woolf, is very much like your daddy. And any strong, independent woman who has chosen to get married to a male partner will have often a husband and like the partner that I chose and who supports me. And so that idea of the nice guy, what I really was showing there in the Josh character was someone who supports and just get the wild spirit and creative, imaginative spirit that is B. And so that actually has a lot of parallels with my own life and finding that for myself, because I was, as a young girl growing up in the Valley, I really was traumatized by the machismo mindset there of the, it looks so much like love, but it's toxic and it's abusive and it devalues the girls and the women. But at the same time, it makes them feel like they are valued. So it's very deceptive. Like, yeah. I love you. And you're doing such valuable work here, cooking my food and doing all these things for me and serving me and sexually being attractive and pleasing me. And it's like, so it in that mindset overtook me as a young girl. And so that's something that took me a very long time to grow out of, even as my role models became, you know, Frida Kahlo and Toni Morrison and all these very strong women writers, Sandra Cisneros. And she's like, you know, watchale, I'm a, you know, ping, 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 I break things. And La B recounts that as mantra. And I did as well growing up. But even so, it took so long to undo that toxic process, that really the toxic masculinity that also has a negative effect on the girls and women who are encountering that in the boys and men that they love.
Yeah, well, Josh was a great contrast. It really was.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I do think that is definitely true of young girls and women who start reading, and we find what we want to hear said in books. But when you exactly. don't find it mirrored in the culture in which you live, in the homes in which you speak to people, it's almost like what is that called? Cognitive dissonance. Like yes. your life is cognitive
exactly.
dissonance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you start to mm-hmm. impose it like, oh, well, he probably meant this, you know, and you twist it. And so that it, to fit that cognitive dissonance. And so you turn, well, what I did, I say you, but what I did and what I think that a lot of younger girls and women who are in these situations, we romanticize the violence and, you know, don't even get me started on like 50 Shades of Grey and all of that, you know, which glorifies and romanticizes it. You know, I'm all for, you know, sexual independence. Absolutely. You want to be kinky, fine. That's amazing. But the exploitation and the toxicity there that was glorified, I can't abide by that. And so I really wanted to show the toxicity but how insidious it is, how much it looks like love at first and how once you have that first taste of love, it's hard then to extricate yourself from that and to try to really believe in your heart and to understand that it's not love. You know, you thought it was love and it's not.
Right.
It's just, thank you for what you've done and for being there in my bed. And you're so fabulous.
Exactly.
You know, it could easily be replaced by the next person willing to do those things for me. You know?
Exactly. Exactly.
So, wow. Well, listen, we can't wait to hear you read from Jubilee. And I think we're getting super close, actually totally ready to hear it. But before we do that, let's have Rand tell us about today's cocktail, which was custom created for this book.
Our cocktail today is called the Jubilee Rumrita, and it's created partly because we know you like rum. You mentioned that to me. And also a margarita to celebrate the Mexicaliness of the novel. The recipe's on the blog if you'd like to make it. Enjoy it. I was waiting to make mine until just this moment so I can sit back and have it. So here's what's in it. Agave nectar, rum, tequila, that's why it's so strong, Heather. Lime juice, Cointreau, and club soda. You put it in a shaker or shake and pour it over some ice with some club soda.
Fantastic. This is delicious. I've been enjoying mine, by the way.
I'm waiting to have mine until after because I was afraid that I would slur through this.
You might have with this drink. Okay, I'm ready whenever you're ready.
Okay, so should I read from Jubilee?
Yeah. Do you want to tell us about the excerpt you're sharing today?
Sure. I was going to read a very short excerpt about who Jubilee is. So, and really the first instance of seeing Jubilee. And so La B is arriving at her brother Maddie's in Santa Ana, which is 4 hours north of the Imperial Valley. She's gone home with Jubilee, and this is really him first encountering her. And then I'm going to jump over to back in time, the year before, and what's led up to Jubilee and La B showing up at Maddie's doorstep. And I want to talk a little bit about, or read an excerpt from La Llorona, the idea of overturning who La Llorona is. In Mexican mythology, there's the ghost story of the crying woman, La Llorona, who killed her children. And that's a story that has long stayed with me. And I, you know, I could go on and on, and I won't. We're running out of time about the colonialist and really sexist and colonialist overtones that are so often excluded from her story and flattened. And I try to give a voice to the idea of La Llorona and see her in a very different way, as many other feminist Latina writers have before me. Sandra Cisneros is one in her Woman Hollering Creek. So I'm going to just read two excerpts to let you know who Jubilee is and then how the idea of La Llorona factors largely into Bee's story. Okay. Bianca nodded again, unsure whether Maddie would be loving or judgmental. Oh my God, come in. He reached for her arm and led her into the house. What happened? He pulled her into his wide body for a hug. Jesus, you're burning up. She tried to speak, couldn't. Here, he said, leading her to the couch. Let me hold your baby. He reached for Jubilee, but Bianca couldn't let go. She hadn't slept for days. She must have looked crazed. A La Llorona out of the waters, stealing dreams. Bee, I'll hold your baby so you can rest. She choked out a sob, letting him take Jubilee as she wobbled backward, landing on a couch that reminded her of the borrowed one she'd been bleeding on for 2 days in the empty house for sale 200 miles away. But soft and beige and beckoning, this one whispered safe, whispered let go. Her eyes fluttered. Maddie said, wait, what the hell? His voice reminded her of a flashing siren. It sounded an alarm, something cold and black top and ugly. She squinted, willing herself not to fall asleep. Was something wrong with Jubilee? She tried opening her mouth to speak, but her tongue scraped sand. She'd become a noiseless womb. Mommy's here, she thought of saying, but she couldn't recognize her own thoughts. Shit, Bianca, what's going on? He seemed repulsed by Jubilee, holding her away from his body unnaturally. Was he angry Bianca had stayed in the valley with Gabe, then come back with Gabe's baby? Maddie had always hated Gabe. A childhood of abuse had given Maddie a sixth sense that Bianca hadn't developed, where she trusted everyone, he trusted no one. Yet surely Maddie would forgive her mistakes now that she was here, that she'd come home, accept her for what she'd become. That's why she'd gone to him instead of Mama. Hug her, she had tried saying. The words wouldn't form. Hold her tight. It's calming. Bianca, what is this? She closed her eyes. Maddie's living room swelled and shrank, a lung breathing her in, breathing her out. Jandro, Maddie yelled. Come help me. Something's wrong with my sister. Jubilee was safe. The flash flood was gone. The arroyo was dry. Bianca was a lungfish drowning. Jandro, get my phone. I need help. So that's the first encounter that we have with Jubilee. And now I'm going to switch over to the past with this chapter called The Restaurant. And this is before Jubilee. The summer before her freshman year in high school, Lily and Bee had spent every night together, staying up until morning, prank calling boys, playing truth or dare, stirring up batches of Rice Krispie treats or Muddy Buddies, watching movies. They'd traipse off to the donut shop on Main Street at the westernmost side of town, three blocks south of their houses, traveling one of two ways. One, shaking their hips down the busy Rio Vista if they wanted to check people out and pause on their trek to talk smack with whomever drove by or happened to be out on their front lawn, or late at night when they needed the protection of the streetlights and the neighborhood watch signs and the porch lights, Rio Vista kept them safe. Or two, sprinting through the potholed back alley if they wanted to get there fast. Like if they needed a sugar rush from chocolate old-fashioned donuts and sweet tea with crushed ice ASAP. Or if they felt like getting spooked by the unlit empty lot that stretched to the end of town limit where old shopping cart pushing vagrants camped out and lit bonfires and barrels, and probably there were ghosts kicking it too. That was the summer before she'd heard of La Llorona roaming the New River, which flowed in the ridge below the cliff and folks said green and soap scummed, carried industrial, urban, and agricultural waste from across the Mexicali border, killing all the fish and reeking worse than the beef plant during the hottest part of summer. Swimming in the river could give a body rashes, sores, or make them violently ill. Mama had told her all that stuff, but she hadn't told her about La Llorona. Sure, She'd played Bloody Mary in bathroom mirrors, sprinkling water on the glass and chanting Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary. And they'd played light as a feather, stiff as a board, but never La Llorona. If Bianca had known about La Llorona then, poor, sad woman who drowned her babies in a fit of rage and heartbreak, then prowled that frothy, stinking river where old men and boys fished but never ate what they caught, perhaps mistaking all the other dead and glowing things entangled there for her lost ones, she would have been scared for sure, and never would have gone through the alley by herself day or night. She never would have met Gabe, washing his pea soup green pickup truck in the driveway of his corner house where the alley met that empty lot. He never would have seen her racing by, her chanclas slapping at the gravel, her dark ponytail flapping at her back, her thick thighs and round hips already pouring from her cuffed jean shorts, her breasts already filling her paisley tank top. He never would have called to her, asking where she was going so fast. She should have kept running. Then she never would have left her yellow-haired best friend behind and scrambled into Gabe's raised pickup to jump the dirt hills behind his house like a dune-covered stunt track, not scared that anyone could fly off the cliff and into the river, not thinking that trucks or loving or the country could be dangerous. Before that summer, she never knew what lay behind the palm trees and branches and rolling mounds of dirt and scraps of junk and trash and probably homeless people's huts. But she did run through the alley. She did meet Gabe, just 2 years older, 16 to her 14, but those 2 years he filled with all the things Mama never had. Caldo de res and sticky red rice filling her belly like embryonic fluid. After Gabe, the world was all nanas and cerveza and brujas and chile con carne and chupacabras. After Gabe, she'd turned into a La Llorona herself. Thank you.
Wow.
I love that last passage especially.
Yeah, we just want to sigh and sit here. That was wonderful. Thank you so much.
We just have a couple of minutes left, but I wanted to ask what advice you would give to writers who are writing about trauma. You really did it so well in Jubilee, writing about Bianca's pain in such a gentle way. What would you tell writers who are going to attempt this?
Oh, I love that question. I have taught several workshops specifically designed to writing trauma, writing shadow. I actually have one that I developed called Writing Into the Underbelly, and it's about Stranger Things, actually, and how the show, the Netflix show Stranger Things, does a great job of writing trauma. And so that's a fun class to teach. So I'm trying to think, because I have basically my whole writing life exists around the idea of how to write trauma in such a way that it doesn't become maudlin or soap opera-esque on the page, but resonates in such a way that the reader feels it as well and then is able to find a kind of healing. And so one of the things that I found is a very useful tool for myself is the idea of writing it colder. But I can't do that on the first draft or maybe even the second or third or fourth drafts. I mean, I really just need, as a writer, to delve into those dark spaces myself. And so that's part of the ritual where I light the candle and ask for inner intercession from my antepasados, my ancestors, or the spirits who protect me, whatever it is that you as a writer believe will protect you, whether that's science, whether that's psychology, whether that's God, whether that's your higher power. So ask for that protection. And then what I do is I turn on some music or have something that's a sensory memory that will help me to access those places of trauma. Smell is great for that, for remembering that time. And then I'll just close my eyes, take a deep breath, and then open them. Sometimes I've tried writing with closed eyes, but you know, it could also just turn into like gobbledygook on the page. Yes. But turning on some music, for instance, parts of Jubilee were written with Lynyrd Skynyrd and other classic rock playing as loud as I possibly could, because I had to drown out the rational brain. I had to drown out the ego that was trying to protect me from the subconscious where the trauma resides. And I had to go deep into the underbelly where it hurts, where it burns, and dredge that out. And so sometimes I had to trick my conscious rational brain and turn it off for a minute, and loud music helps me to access that. So whatever will help you access it, get it out on the page and, you know, make sure that you're supported. You know, I had family with me and around me. I often was speaking with a therapist. So make sure that you're supported, because sometimes as I was writing and as I write my poetry and my fiction, I'm not necessarily ready to discover the truths of, you know, what's deep down there in the underbelly. So taking a break, knowing that it's okay to walk away from the work for a while, but get it out there. It is your story. You're speaking truth to power. And I firmly believe that violence and toxicity are allowed to fester where there's silence. And when we speak, we heal. We heal our ancestors, we heal the past, we heal ourselves, and we heal the future. So really just getting it out there on the page. And then as a writer, then it's going to be time to come back and craft it and write it colder and really distance yourself from it and come at it a few passes, because sometimes what came out when I had the music loud was just, you know, I would have sentences that went on a single run-on sentence that would last a page, because it's just like I was pulling it up from the underbelly, and it was one thing was connecting to the next. And so then knowing how to sort through that, that's where workshops can come in handy and other writers who can help you and mentors. And so I'd absolutely hook up with other writers who can help you craft that. But I would say my biggest piece of advice is just not to be afraid and not to worry that your story doesn't have value, or be afraid that it's going to be labeled as confessionalist, or it's going to be poo-pooed for being too much about trauma and all these things. No, I mean, we need that kind of literature. There is a place for your story, and just to believe in that and dredge it up from within yourself and get it on the page.
Thank you so much for that. That's really wonderful advice.
Can you tell us a little bit about, we're at the very end of the podcast, and I know that it's important to dig deep and get to the underbelly, but it's also important to have this variation of joy and pain. And I'm curious if you can just let us into what you anticipate that you're hoping for, or what might bring you some joy in life and literature in the next 12 months.
Oh, I love that question. So I stay so curious as I'm teaching my kids. I'm homeschooling them right now. And Jubilee came from really an imaginative idea of a young woman who loves this doll and mothers this doll. And so the joy is absolutely there. And that's what Jubilee represents. I mean, that's what the title itself means, is the Jubilee. And so for myself, I am looking forward to exploring all of these fantastic ideas as I'm learning with my kids, relearning things and discovering things anew and finding connections and really just looking for places that I get excited about living, despite, even though there are so many dark and scary things happening around us, there are still so many magical things. I go out and I look at the stars, and I look my roses. I thought they had died. They had completely withered. And then I started looking up how to take care of them. And now right before the fall is here and things are going to start dying, my roses came back. And that's beautiful. That's magic. And so I'm just enjoying those beautiful moments with my children and with nature and ideas. And I can't wait to start my next book.
We can't wait either. And we appreciate you taking time out to come talk to us today so much. And we really love listening to you read from your work.
So everybody, go get Jennifer Givon's gorgeously wrought book, Jubilee. The link is in the podcast description. Be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on the booktales, readings, and drinks for this podcast series. And also subscribe to the podcast. It releases once a month for more conversation with amazing literary authors. Thanks again for listening to Booktales. See you next time. ¶¶